Minister. As you're aware, we've had public hearings for 2 days. We've had a briefing on this bill. Today is the last submissions we're looking at. We were expecting three oral submissions today. Unfortunately, AfriForum, has the person that was dealing with the matter has met with an accident, so he's not available to make inputs. We wish him well, of course. I'm not sure we've ascertained how bad it is. So we do have Erasmus Environmental Development and Property Law attorneys, and we're very fortunate also to have the Western Cape Government Environmental Affairs and Development Planning here today, which will give us some angle on these issues from a government perspective, which we haven't had, which will be useful. So those will be the last two submissions we're dealing with. Unfortunately, that's all we received. We will, after the meeting, also deal with a program for the next two terms. I hope people have received copies, just to finish that quickly. All right, for those that have are here today, I see the Western Cape is there, they can come forward just now. The way we deal with it, usually we give you 10 to 15. I say 10 to 15 depending on how much sense you're talking. If you talk a lot of sense, you go beyond 10. If you don't talk a lot of sense, I stop you at 10 minutes. It's quite important that you make only the points that are dealing with amendments, really, because you must assume that we've read the rest. So it's important that we try and spend the maximum time on the amendments you either support or against. It's very useful. And then, of course, there may be some questions afterwards. So our first input today, do I have a copy of that, Zuleika? This one. Erasmus Environmental Development and Property Attorney. Sorry, I don't see your surname here, so I imagine it's you.
It's Kali Erasmus.
Kali Erasmus, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erasmus. Over to you. Do you have a... it is your slide presentation.
Thank you, Mr.
So there is a written submission, but then we also have the slide presentation, which looks like this, okay? Thank you. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. As I explained in our written submission, I have a background in law, which in environmental terms goes back to the dark days of the Middle 80s. But in addition to that, I was the founding head of the Center for Development Administration at the University of South Africa, now the Center for Development Studies. And I suspect you will find that I have a slightly different perspective from those who have a background only in law or only in the social sciences or only in indeed the natural sciences. I will stick to your prescript, Mr. Chair. I do, however, just want to underscore the growing concern that, laudable and formidable though the South African framework for environmental governance may be, it is very much an endangered species, which is under threat because it doesn't work for three key groups of stakeholders: ordinary South Africans, developers and investors, and government. It's indictment, Mr. Chair, that there are more people in more places, particularly historically disadvantaged individuals, in toxic environmental circumstances than ever before, with our law and our authorities seemingly unable to redress those. The challenges faced by developers and investors have been well articulated, and government, as is evident from the National Development Plan published recently, finds itself between a rock and a hard place as to how to deliver a better life for all. I'm personally increasingly concerned by a rising fundamentalism amongst individuals who seek to bubble wrap the environment, and I would strongly submit that this committee, this government, these authorities must make it an articulated objective to find an appropriate balance. Moving on to the actual... I don't propose walking you through our written submission, Mr. Chair. I take that as read. There are particular aspects that I would like to raise, both out of my own submissions and those made by others. And if I could get this slide to move on, it would it would be useful. I have no idea what is going on here. The first issue I wish to deal with, Mr. Chair, is the proposed insertion of, I believe it is sections 24, 5, A, B, and C, 24 capital letters C, 4, 5, and 6, which propose that the national minister can be asked to take a decision where an MEC fails to do so. Now, Mr. Chair, one of the recurring problems with the framework for environmental governance is that it simply takes provinces too long to take decisions. The reason for that, Mr. Chair, is that we have provincial departments that are overburdened and under-resourced, and they simply do not get to it. To outsource the problem and dump the national department with the inabilities of provinces simply compounds the issue. I would respectfully submit that it is unconstitutional, unlawful, and unworkable. To begin with, Mr. Chair, in terms of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, it is a mandatory requirement that all relevant information must be taken into account when an administrative decision is taken justly. When it comes to environmental authorizations, the information that needs to be taken into account is within the exclusive domain of the province. There are databases, there are internal memos, there are perceptions or understandings of visits. None of that, Mr. Chair, is in the possession of an applicant or the national minister. And what this proposal suggests is that an applicant must put enough information before the national minister to enable her to take the decision. And then it becomes even more cloudy, Mr. Chair. The application in respect of which the minister will now be taking a decision is an exclusive competence of the MEC. So what happens if somebody wants to appeal that decision? Does that appeal lie to the MEC who failed to take the decision in the first place, as is provided for by NEMA? What is the position of interested and affected parties? How are they consulted with regard to such an application? How do they participate in it? How do they make inputs into that exercise? Mr. Chair, it simply does not work. The bottom line, Mr. Chair, is that those who wrote the Constitution foresaw dysfunction at provincial level and made provision for what to do in such circumstances. We've seen those measures implemented in Limpopo, in the Eastern Cape and elsewhere, and the departments can't have their cake and eat it. If provincial departments are dysfunctional, national government is constrained to implement those provisions in the Constitution. If not, they need to address the situation.
So what are you saying? They must use either Section 100.
Well, Mr. Chair, what is going to happen?
125.
Is the objective of this proposal is to foreshorten the process. It is going to exponentially increase it, because as you well know.
No, let's not argue that first. I'm trying to listen to you about the constitutionality.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Are you saying the only way it can then be dealt with, if this is not possible constitutionally, forget all the practicalities, then one will have to use Section 100?
That is my understanding, Mr. Chair.
And what about 125.1c? Won't that be catered for yet?
Mr. Chair, I'm not a constitutional expert.
I've always wondered, I read all these newspapers and they tell us about all these education problems which are similar. In 125.1c, I don't have my constitution. Oh, here's a constitution. What we did there is we foresaw these things happening, like the textbooks and child food scheme. And what we did was we allowed in the constitution that executive powers can be taken away from a province through an act of parliament. We'll get to your practicalities, because I think what you're saying is worth listening to. But I'm first trying to try and get a legal framework. 125.1c says the Premier exercises the executive authority together with the other members of the Executive Council by implementing all national legislation within the functional areas listed in Schedule 4 and 5 and this is an important thing that no one seems to ever read, except where the Constitution or an Act of Parliament provides otherwise. So I'm jumping on this here. I'm not expecting an answer from you. Maybe you can think about it when we go through it further. Because the one thing I want to sort out is the legal framework and then the practicalities of it. I mean, you're making... So please just bear that one in mind, because I think those are the two clauses, 100 and 125, we put in exactly where things break down in a province, that one can deal with it properly. And it seems to me that this clause may well fall under 125, because what it does, it potentially takes away the power from the province, as the Act allows it to do, where the provinces can't perform it. It may have to be articulated more clearly, because as your point you make, just written like this, it doesn't really...
Well, Mr. Chair, that's exactly the point. As it is written, the minister, in fact, the national minister effectively descends into the province, takes a provincial decision, and the appeal then lies to the provincial appeal authority.
Yeah, there may have to be more... Okay. No, go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt you, but you can think about this more.
Mr. Chair, The remaining comments are largely pragmatic and flow to a very large extent from other comments that have been shared with us. It is unfortunate that the draft bill is not consistent in terms of how it defines emergencies and responses thereto. Section 24, capital letter F3, includes a reference to property. Section 24, G4 does not. There have been submissions made to this committee that the word property should be removed from both. I would strongly oppose that suggestion. It is anti-developmental, it is cruel, and ultimately it is environmentally unsound. People's responses to what happens to them is dictated more often than not by their relationship to things, not just the environment broadly defined. It also makes no sense, Mr. Chair, to say that if, for example, a national installation is at threat or is threatened, that there is no provision for an emergency response that may be in contravention of the provisions of NEMA. What is missing from this provision, Mr. Chair, and where the Centre for Environmental Rights is correct, is there is no link between the scope and the nature of the response and the scope and the nature of the emergency. What needs to be put in here is that a response must be appropriate to the nature and scope, and that a self-induced or negligently induced emergency is no defense, either to prosecution or to escaping the provisions of Section 24G. The failure to include such a provision is ultimately extremely dangerous. Now, Mr. Chair, I am...
What is that, G4? Section
24G4 and 24F3. Mr. Chair, if I may move on, I must say I'm gobsmacked at suggestions that Section 24, capital letter G, is somehow a legislative anomaly or an aberration. It is a simple fact that people have always... are still and will always undertake activities that in contravention of the applicable environmental legislation. And it makes no sense whatsoever to legislate what needs to be done in those circumstances. One of the biggest problems, Mr. Chair, that was experienced with the Environment Conservation Act under the previous legislative dispensation was that it contained no such provision. So when an activity was commenced or undertaken, all that anybody could do was to order them to break down, rehabilitate, whether that was appropriate or not. And we strongly submit that Section 24, capital letter G, is applied common sense. The difficulties that are being experienced with it and the accusations that are being used to cover environmental crimes are a nonsense. Can I move on? There is no basis for that suggestion. No, thank you.
I mean, the more appropriate problem there is that you have 11 different institutions applying it because there's no one set of rules to guide them properly. That's maybe the bigger problem.
No, Mr. Chair, it's an even simpler problem. The failure, refusal, and or neglect of competent authorities to criminally charge people who have committed offences and have applied for rectification in terms of Section 24G is one of the greatest anomalies in our enforcement of our environmental legislation. It doesn't take rocket science, Mr. Chair, to distinguish the penal provisions of Section 24F from the administrative provisions of Section 24G. They're entirely different. There is no prohibition against criminally charging an applicant for rectification in respect of the activity that it, he or she has unlawfully undertaken. It has been done in many instances. There's a reported, or I'm not sure whether it's a reported case, of the Capital Park filling station. I have a letter which I have not shared with this committee dated as recently as last week from the Gauteng Department confirming that there is no prohibition against the simultaneous undertaking bail. The arguments for the removal of Section 24G or for it somehow being an excuse for environmental crime, I would strongly submit, holds no water. Can we move on? Mr. Chair, I have raised this issue before and I will keep raising it. It is an amendment omitted from the bill. I cannot believe that Section 43.7 of NEMA still exists. In terms of Section 43.7, it is provided that an appeal does not suspend an authorization unless otherwise directed. This sterilizes the most fundamental check and balance against flawed decision-making in the South African law. What boggles my mind, Mr. Chair, is that NEMA contains a statutory constraint to caution. It is provided by Section 23 of NEMA that no action must be taken until everything has been considered. Yet we sit with Section 43.7, which in theory means, Mr. Chair, that if an environmental authority were, by way of example, to authorize the bulldozing of the sand dunes at St. Lucia, by the time an appeal succeeds, irretrievable damage would have been done. It is inconceivable, Mr. Chair, that this committee and this law can persist with a position that allows environmental prejudice even when it is possibly unauthorized. The legal ramifications, Mr. Chair, are severe. Because let's assume there is a successful appeal. Then we may sit with a situation that nobody can be held to account. Whoever caused the environmental damage would have done so lawfully in terms of an authorization properly issued.
This clause is not being amended, is it?
No, Mr. Chair. You're
just mentioning.
My question is, why not?
Okay.
See that as a matter. May I move on? Finally, Mr. Chair, an issue that impacts directly on this presentation. We had hoped to provide this committee with certain empirical analysis of particularly applications in terms of Section 24G, but have been met with what I consider to be one of the most bizarre situations ever. When we ask for access to the registers that departments keep in terms of Section of Regulation 11, we're told that we have to apply in terms of PIO. You can go to any court and see the register of court cases. You can go to any organ of state. The registers are public documents. It gets worse, Mr. Chair. In those instances where we represent clients directly affected by known applications in terms of Section 24G, where we discover the existence of those applications by mistake, those directly affected parties also have to apply in terms of Promotion of Access to Information Act. I instructed the candidate attorney to try and get the bottom of it, and the report I received was that there has been a collective decision that higher requests are required before these registers are made available. With respect, Mr. Chair, that's wrong.
But why is it wrong?
Because
I drafted by year, well, I helped draft it in Parliament.
Mr.
And
Chair?
That is the act that the Constitution asked us to draft to give access to all information in the country.
May I respond to that?
Why would we now create a loophole in environmental law? And Pahia won't.
No, Mr. Chair, I'm not arguing for a loophole. If I could use a court as an example, the register, the list of cases issued in that court, is a public document. The cases themselves, the actual records, are protected by PAHIA. To give one your practical example, Party A, who is the proprietor of a filling station, learns that the filling station across the road from him is unlawful and that application has been made in terms of PAHIA, in terms of Section 24G of NEMA for rectification. The person, the proprietor of the filling station won't give him any joy. The oil company won't give him any joy. He goes to the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development in Gauteng and says, is it correct that this is unlawful and that there's an application? Can I have a look at the registers to see who has applied for what? They say no. What ought to happen, Mr. Chair, is that he ought to be allowed to inspect that register. If he requires one of the applications, the substantive applications, I have no problem that PAHIA ought to apply with that.
Can I make a suggestion? Obviously, the regulations we're not looking at here. Can I suggest, if you've got an example of this, you just forward to us in a letter?
I have to every one of the competent authorities, Mr. Chair.
So, and then just send it to us. Let me look at it separately from this process, okay? There may be an easy answer to this, and we'll have a look at it. But it's difficult not having the regulations in front of us because we're not dealing with it. But can I suggest we follow that process?
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Because I hear what you're saying. It's the list of applications you're seeking, not the applications themselves.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Gauteng used to have it on their website.
Okay.
Now they think that's applying in terms of PAHIA.
Let's look at that, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my submission.
There isn't PAHIA clauses that allow that to be put in a public section of PAHIA. So there may be an easy solution.
Thank you.
We'll have a look at it with the officials are behind you. I'll talk to them as well. But just give me an example so I can talk to them on a specific example, okay?
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you. There's some very good suggestions. Well, let me not preempt what is good and what's bad. There's a lot of issues raised here that are worth looking at. And please let us see if there are any questions, any answers, any comments. Anyone? Mr. Morgan?
I am not particularly about anything that you've spoken about. For a first practitioner who works in the field, engages with authorization, represents clients, I'd be very interested in you in giving us some sense from your point of view the type of problems that competent authorities are having in turning applications around, giving decisions, because some of the things you talk, I mean, your first substantial slide about the relation between two spheres, of between national and provincial, you make the point that, in fact, it could worsen the situation. So just to substantiate that, give us a sense of, from your point of view, what is happening in practical terms. What are the struggles that provinces are happening and why? Just to go beyond the few points you picked out on your PowerPoint presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Scorzano?
Chair, thank you very much. I just want to ask a presenter, Chairperson, on page 2, where the bulletin number 1 says the proposal that the minister can be asked to take a decision when NMEC fails to do so is an acknowledgement of dysfunction in the provinces. I just want to ask Chair, the presenter to elaborate on his thinking about this thing, because if he's having a doubt whether this thing will be handled accordingly, I just want to hear his views so that he can assist us. And also, I should think it can be good if it can be put in writing with those chairs that you have asked, that it must be in writing. Thanks.
Dr. Huang, not Ms. Wenger, Ms. Bengel. Just remind me, which clause is the emergency clause you've now put in?
It's an amendment to section 24G4, if I remember correctly, Mr. Thiel, or 24F3.
Clause 8.
I'd be in the poll, so I'm referring to the section 8B.
Right. Which one? 28, you say clause 8 in the bill.
Clause 8 in the bill, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I was referring to the section in the bill.
Page 7. The minister refused to issue. Is it that one? It's not applicable to a person contemplated. That one. Subsection 2A is not applicable. I thought there was a longer clause here dealing with emergencies. 24? F. I'm just, while I'm looking for this, Mr. Erasmus, I'm just trying to find the second bullet point you made, that there's not a link between the nature and scope of the response and the nature and scope of the emergency. So I'm trying to look in the amendment. Are you referring to the
Chair,
the
that, that occurs in the Act itself.
In the Act, okay. That's why I couldn't find it. All right. So you're saying in the Act, it should be limited to the extent that your response to the emergency should be equal to whatever you're trying to remedy.
It should be proportionate, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
To define it as closely as equal would be looking for trouble.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. So that's the Act itself that you're talking about. Okay. All right. Well, I've asked that question now, so we don't have to worry. You can respond to those two and see. We'll see if there are others.
Mr. Chair, proceeding purely on practicality, there are two major problems. The emphasis in this process has been on the constraints experienced by the departments themselves. What everybody has been entirely silent on is the shockingly poor submissions departments often get, and the extent to which departments go, in our experience, to try and fix what are in effect broken processes. Our departments are far too shy to hold environmental assessment practitioners and applicants responsible for non-compliant submissions. So on the one hand, one has a major problem that those responsible for managing these processes do not do their jobs properly. That compounds an already difficult situation, looking at it from the outside in. There's an old adage, Mr. Chair, that where you stand depends on where you sit. I accept I don't sit in the seat of an environmental competent authority. But high staff turnover rates, incomplete submissions, increasingly recalcitrant applicants make it or contribute to the fact that decisions take a long time to happen. So those are the two problems. When I was trying to be a little controversial in calling it dysfunction, because I think we need to understand how draconian this proposed amendment is. What this amendment is saying is that those departments are incapable of taking decisions to the extent that the national minister must somehow be able to do so. I don't think that necessarily is the problem. I think we can address the root causes. I think it would be better from every perspective to do so. I've to an extent addressed the question from, I believe it's Mr. Skosana. When I refer to dysfunction, I simply mean the inability to properly discharge their statutory and constitutional mandate. And there are various contributory causes there too. They're addressed in my written submission. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? That seems quite clear. Mr. Morgan?
I would never do that. I don't think it is I don't think it is physically or lawfully possible under any circumstances. The fact is, the decision maker is required by PAJA, the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, to take all relevant information into account. A significant amount of that information is proprietary and exclusive to the province, will not be at the disposal of the applicant, will not be before the national minister, and will result in a fundamentally and irrevocably flawed decision.
But if you draft it as you suggested, let's first assume for now that it can be there. May constitution not be able to? If it can, I mean, if you redraft the clause and you do it properly with all the steps and so on, all the things you're saying can't happen, you can put it in the law that it should happen.
Mr. Chair, the physical difficulty is the following. The information required to take that decision vests in the provincial officials and in the provincial archives. How do you legislate the making available of that information to the national minister when those officials...
All the information that's available to the province must be given to the national.
How long will
they take,
Mr. Chair?
No, well, let's not... You see, what I'm trying to deal with is one bite at a time. I take one bite at a time. Firstly, what I'm trying to look at, whether it's possible to do it. Then, of course, once we've looked at it, whether it's legally possible, then we look at whether it's feasible and whether it's we want to have it like that.
Mr. Chair,
the problem is that for what's happening now, is that the problem is it's fine to say we must fix up the provinces, which is the right answer. The problem is if you don't fix up the right the provinces, then what's happening in those people in the provinces are then going to do these things without the authorization. They're not going to wait for the authorization. Then we're back at 24F. We have to then approve the lack of authorization that's taken place. So the problem is, there's a lot of sense in what you say that the competency should invest in the province or in local government for that matter. But if it doesn't invest there, what does government do then? Because your answer will be, well, go fix it up. Well,
hey, Mr. Chair, there are two. We have officials with many years of experience. The difficulty in addressing that problem is so great that there's a provision in NEMA, and it escapes me the precise definition, which provides that where the national minister is required to consult an MEC, writing a letter and not getting an answer is sufficient. That CYB, cover your backside provision, simply acknowledges that where national government is required to be placed in possession of this particular type of information, it doesn't happen. I'm not suggesting that government sit back and do nothing. The fact is that there is a framework in the legislation. There are time frames. If those time frames are not adhered to, an applicant is free to seek recourse in the courts. And that, unfortunately, is at the moment the preferred option of many, because it's the only way we get decisions. And
so now if national government now wants to say, well, we don't want people to go to court and waste their money, because very few people actually have money to go to court, as you well know, we rather want to try and create another procedure whereby it's made easier for people then to get an answer. Of course, then they can go to court if they want to.
Mr. Chair, can I interrupt for a second? My difficulty is with the relocation of the information needed to take the decision from province to national. It would make far more sense to empower the minister to delegate that decision-making authority to a particular person who is either appointed in or selected from the province. If there is a decision-making difficulty, give the minister some form of authority to designate or delegate a particular individual to take that decision within a particular time frame. What happens with the present modalities, Mr. Chair, is we're still going to have to go to court. The only problem is we're now going to have to wait another 18 months as we exhaust yet another set of internal remedies. It is going to cost people more, it is going to take longer, and it's going to lead to greater frustration. We need to find a mechanism. I'm not an experienced official, Mr. Chair. I do not know how to structure it. We need to find a way of enabling that decision within the departments that are responsible for implementing this legislation.
I've got some ideas as you talk, but I think you've, I mean, what you've done in your input, which is important, you've awoken that problem for us. Because everyone now has just supported it until now. You're the first one that actually, and I can see that there is the potential for difficulty. Definitely legally we'll have to draft it much more carefully. And secondly, your point is that maybe one shouldn't directly just say the power should go to the minister. Maybe it would be layers of other things that we can first create in the law where the minister can try and make sure that the province does take the decision. So there's all possibilities there. So I'm hearing what you say. Mr. Morgan?
They may want to comment. I mean, thank you for alerting us to that. It's an important thing to think about. I can imagine, and the reason I asked you the first question to sort of describe the problems was to really get a sense of ideas, like things like backlogs in provinces, maybe better in some, worse than others. But if we have a system where people have, as you said, they don't go to the courts, they then go to national for a decision, and I take into account everything you said about how difficult and practical it is. We, of course, there are backlogs in all provinces to some extent, and there are problematic applications and all sorts of things. You get the potential then, without much predictability, a whole bunch of applications getting on to the desk of the national minister. And particularly if people want to use it as another way to actually get a decision. I think what you're saying, I'm going to restate it, of course, is that going to court, you go through the process anyway at a provincial level, and you would normally just then go to court if there's a problem to get a decision. Now you go through the process, and then you don't get a decision, go to national. And you'd go to court then if you don't get a decision there, in the sense that you've made the process theoretically twice as long anyway. But beyond that as well, it also, potentially, to the department something to ponder and talk to us about at another stage. This potentially is going to completely clog up national departments' authorization system, so much so that you won't be able to make any decisions either. And then are caught in a proportionate share of all the court challenges that would have been spread around the country at the same time. So I'm just trying to think through some of the things I think you've told me. Perhaps you can't tell me if I'm right or not, but those are some of the problems that I've...
Mr. Chair, just a brief comment. As I say, we were trying to do a more extensive empirical investigation. In the 182 environmental impact assessments in which we participated in one way or another over the past year or two, not a single decision was taken within the prescribed timeframes. That would mean that every single one of those applications, some of which are for trifling developments, would have landed within the national department, and that is perhaps our biggest fear, Mr. Chair, is that while one may be able to address backlogs or constraints at a provincial level, how does one do that when you lumber all these applications on the national department?
Of course, it doesn't all happen automatically. It's only if the applicant applies to the ministry. So it's still in the control of the applicant. So all the things that you're saying, you as a good attorney, when your client asks you, must I now apply to the national minister, you obviously going to say no.
Chair, may I respond? We have a peculiar position. We as often act in opposition to applications as for applications. I do not know of a single developer, and I have worked with many, who would not jump at the 1991 to push that application to national. This is a recipe for disaster in pure practical terms.
Why would the developer? Because they don't want the decision to be taken.
No, Mr. Chair. The experience and the compliment is intended is that levels of efficacy and efficiency on a national level are far higher than at a provincial level. There are many reasons for that. But there is far more confidence in the national department in many spheres. And my sense is that what one would find is a deluge. The one issue that may have been ignored is, remember, this is not just applications going forward. This is also the backlog of applications that have already exceeded the statutory deadline. So on day after promulgation, 10,000 applications are going to rain down on National Department and will never surface again.
Can I suggest, Mr. Rasmus, the department tell us they're busy with a bigger review than this. This is a kind of a stopgap, what they came and told us. There's a bigger review taking place. Are we in the department, have we notified people? For example, Mr. Rasmus has raised quite a few other issues here, Section 43.7 and so on. Are you accepting their comments of other people to issues that need to be amended? How are you doing this review of yours? I know we're waiting for a memo from you to explain it to us, but let me just try and get some clarity.
Chair, just in terms of our process, before we actually go and amend anything, there's a comprehensive process which, with all due respect to Mr. Erasmus, I don't think he appreciates. The point is that we go through a process.
Hey, you're not answering my question. Don't get sick on Mr. Erasmus.
No, sir.
Because he's making a submission. This is why, you see why I said to you in the beginning, why I don't ask the department to comment while they submission. Exactly, because you're now looking for a fight with Mr. Erasmus.
No, I'm not.
Now I'll ask you a simple question. Now let me read. I know I'm Afrikaans and I express myself badly in English. Let me try again with you. What I am asking, and I'm talking slowly, is simply this. You are busy with a process of review of legislation. I asked a question to you. Are you accepting information from the public as well to guide that process or not? Now, I can't put it simpler than that. If you want me to put in Afrikaans, if you want me to put it in Zulu, I can get someone to translate in Zulu. But that is a simple question, not for you to attack Mr. Erasmus. Can we try again?
Yes, Chair. Chair, there is a process to engage members of the public, but there's a prior process to that as well where we engage the other provincial departments and people that implement this legislation as well. So there's a comprehensive process in terms of environmental departments, other government departments, and then members of the public. And those comments are then incorporated before we actually present the amended bill or amended legislation.
Mr. Erasmus, because you've taken all this effort, can I ask you if there are anything in this bill that you would have liked to see raised which hasn't been raised? Could you please send those submissions to me and I will personally send it to the department to include in their process?
Mr. Chair, may I make one comment? My expertise is as a process expert. And the process just described explains many of the shortcomings in the legislation. Once the authorities, all of whom who sit in the same functional chair, have looked and composed and compiled and formulated draft amendments. That is their position. It is one which they have discussed with one another, it's one with which they are comfortable, and it is one which experience has shown they are willing to protect. The difficulty with that way of doing things, and I accept there are hassles in terms of opening this debate to public participation prematurely, is that you only have one perspective. You only have the officials dealing with what they consider to be the problems. There is a very strong case to be made, Mr. Chair, for the selective inclusion of others who can be bound to confidentiality. There is no reason, Mr. Chair, why the Centre for Environmental Rights is not in on this process on day one. There is no reason, Mr. Chair, why Business Unity South Africa is not in on day one. There is no reason. There are not many of us who are expert in the environmental field.
But that doesn't happen anywhere in the world. Governments govern.
Accepted, Mr. Chair.
I accept whatever criticisms you give, there may be shortcomings of that process, but we're not going to change that.
Can I make... There is, as far as I understand the process, and I served on the faculty of the South African Leadership Program at the John F. Kennedy School of Government, there are in some states a prior almost think tank process where members of the public are invited, or not members of the public, where people within the fold are invited to make submissions to be taken into account in that consultative process by government. That's effectively what you've asked me to do now, is before the department finalizes a draft bill, before they commit their thinking into that structure, the format, to develop a database of individuals and say, where do the hassles lie? Do you have proposals? Do you mind sharing them with us?
Now that's why, because you've made the effort, suggesting that you give me whatever you have so that I can, from the parliamentary committee side, say that these must be taken into consideration without telling them how to change their processes, which I have no power to do, to tell the minister how to run her department. Okay? So can any issues you want to raise with us, which is not in this legislation, send it to us and I'll pass it through to the department and make sure they take into consideration. Okay. Any further questions or issues? And again, I want to say to the department, when I do ask you for submission, you know, we had it yesterday, last time as well, I had to start, the young lady that was there, I had to start fighting because you disagreed with her. I don't want, when I ask the department to comment, when the public, you see, why we don't ask the public to comment? Exactly because we don't want to start a dialogue where you disagree. So we want you, when you respond to these things, where you disagree, just keep quiet and just leave it. And just, we will have to make a decision about these things. But I want to say this in public so the public can hear this. When I ask the department when submissions are, of course, when we come later and we process the amendment, then you're free to comment as much as you like and disagree and so on, because then this committee must hear your point of view. But while the people are here, it then looks as if we're listening to the department as a committee, because you disagree. He says, that's what I'm trying to avoid. On the other hand, I don't have the information, so I must get it from somewhere. So I have to ask you for the information. So please bear in mind, I should have said this much more clearly, it's my fault, previously. We're not here to engage and start arguments with submission. Because when that person leaves here, he says, yeah, you see, he gave the department a chance now to comment and say that I'm wrong and so on, so on, so on. And that is then the lasting feeling people left it. That other lady walked out here, she was quite unhappy. Again, she raised things that are not in the bill. I should never have asked you for a comment on it. So when you commented and she disagreed, then a dialogue starts. So those are the kind of things we try and avoid, okay? Please, let's try and deal with it. Mr. Erasmus, can I just say thank you very much for taking the effort and time. We will next week start processing. Every single suggestion you've made would be looked at in the processing of this matter. And as I've said, if you want to make any further submissions, please let me have them so I can then process them further with the department on matters that are not part of these bills in this other process we're busy with. So thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure. Thank you again, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir.
May I be excused?
You may definitely be.
Thank you. I may hang around for
a while. I know for lawyers, time is money, so I know that...
Mr. Chair, I practice in Prince Albert. Time is less relevant. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's a far away from you. It's quite far. Can the Western Cape government come forward? Where are we? Oh, here we are. Here we are. Are you alone? No, let them come here. We want to see them. They must come and face the music with you. Please come and sit forward here. Sit with this gentleman, face the music. One of them is there. I can see. come to greener pastures, my friend. Green is appropriate, yeah. Also a document, I hope you all have it, is from Mr. Erasmus. It's an analysis of section 24G. Looks like this. Make sure it's in your package, okay? Number? The submission for the Western Cape government is number 13. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you very much for taking the effort of being here, particularly as you're the only government structure that's cared to do so. It's much appreciated. Over to you. Try and concentrate on the amendments you would either support or disagree with so we can have some dialogue around those if you can. So welcome.
Thank you, Chair. If I just start with the amendments. First thing I want to suggest is that the National Environmental Laws Amendment Bill should also cater for amendments to be made to the schedule which is contained in the National Environmental Management Amendment Act.
What's in that schedule? Sorry,
I've just cut off the...
are you going to deal with it?
Yeah, I've actually
cut
off the relevant sections of the schedule itself which should be amended. NEMA will be amended to the extent specified in the schedule with effect from the date 18 months after the commencement of the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Amendment Act of 2008. Therefore, the schedule itself should also be amended by the bill, particularly all the definitions which specifically, again, the definitions of minister and Minister of Minerals and Energy. I'll just cut off the relevant sections there, which you can look at afterwards. Clarity should also be provided to indicate that pending the commencement of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Amendment Act, environmental authorization must be granted in respect of non-mining specific activities listed in the National Environmental Management 2010 EIA listing notices. Just for an example, some of the activities which I'm referring to are the removal of indigenous vegetation within a critically endangered or endangered ecosystem. The biometric clarification is sought basically to prevent further litigation between organs of state pending any discussions to amend the current procedure which is to come into force after the date of commencement of the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Amendment Act. In this regard, it's also been noted that the Provincial Departments of Environmental Affairs have not been a party to any discussions with regards to law reform relating to this issue. On the next slide, section one.
The point you're making there is that in lieu of that having not been a put into force in the environment, you're saying that we must just make this law applicable to non-mining.
Essentially, Chair, there was a dispute essentially before the Max Sands case, before judgment came out there. Unfortunately, the clarification which is sought in that judgment was not provided by the court. Essentially, what the departments were asking were, Minerals was essentially alleging that if a minerals right is granted to an applicant, they don't need to obtain environmental authorization. That was the Department of Minerals stance. Environmental Affairs was then obviously saying that only pertains to the list of activities which pertain to mining, which haven't come into force. The list of activities which are non-mining specific listed activities, so your removal of critically endangered vegetation, construction with 100 meters of high water mark, all of those listed activities, authorization is still required from Environmental Affairs. And that's the clarification we are seeking. We're basically trying to preempt a further litigation between state departments, which will be inevitable should this clarification not be provided.
The way I tried to find out from the department, they've given me something, but that's not the answer. The way this would work is, of course, if when the proclamation is made to put the law into effect, you would exclude from the proclamation that which should not start operating. And the obvious thing is that you exclude it's not applicable to Mineral Affairs. Unfortunately, when I looked at the proclamation just put the whole act into operation. So I'm still trying to find the answer, why is the Act not applicable to Mineral Affairs? I know all the issues and there was another law drafted, but another law being drafted and not being put in effect cannot be the reason why it's not applicable. Because in this law, their name is there and it's applicable. So I'm still trying to find out, and if you have an answer, if you don't, how is it that the Act mentions Mineral Affairs and it's not applicable, because as I say, the proclamation makes the whole act applicable, and I can't find out legally why Mineral Affairs is not applicable to Mineral Affairs. I know all the politics around it and I know all the agreements that the previous committee did, but that's not law. That's things that have been drafted that have not been put into effect. If you guys can shed any light on it, please do, but otherwise please go ahead.
I think the department could actually reply better to that. But basically because those listed activities haven't been commenced with yet, for which the Minister of Minerals and Energy is the competent authority, and which is why we're seeking this clarity. So there's two points, whether the Minister of Minerals and Energy is the competent authority to deal with that, and has amended, the Minister has amended, and then secondly, whether the non-mining listed activities apply or not. And there was the differentiation. So the proclamation.
But you see, what I'm trying to—the technical thing I'm trying to find out. If you look on page 6 of the bill now, it says the minister in square brackets Mineral Energy Affairs, and then it replaces Mineral Energy Affairs responsible for mineral resources or an MEC concern. So this is section 24(g), where it's very clear that it's applicable to the mineral. Now, I'm trying to work out in my head, is everyone says, but it's not applicable to the Minister of Mineral, and I look at this and I say, but I see them there. Now, there technically, legally has to be. Now, I asked them to give me the proclamation. They gave me a proclamation. I looked at the proclamation. The proclamation just put the whole act into it. It didn't say, except as far as it's applicable to the Minister of Mineral Resources. It didn't say that. So I'm still trying in my own head to find out, I don't know if it's of any relevance, but I'm trying to find out why this act is not applicable, at least this section then. I mean, I haven't looked at the rest of the act.
Chair, I think a lot of the answers might be in the National Environmental Management Amendment Act of 2008, that Act 62 of 2008. I think that would provide a bit of clarification for you in terms of how they say...
Is that the one that hasn't been put into operation?
Certain parts of the... That act was, so that did amend NEMA, but I think it's section 13 of that amendment act, which provides for the schedule to come into force as well. which then says upon the commencement of the Mineral Resources Petroleum Development Amendment Act, this schedule will come into force, and then that schedule then replaces certain sections in the Act and deletes certain references. I'm not sure that's answering your question.
They also gave an answer like that, but my problem is, of course, that Act hasn't been put into operation. So it can't have an effect on this Act. So until this Act has been put in. But let's leave it at that. I think what I do need is both the department and yourselves to go, if you've got the answer, to give it to me. Because that must be a simple thing. If everyone is so sure it's not applicable, there must be a very simple answer somewhere. But it can't be the answer that they gave me, is that the next Act that was passed then changed the relationship. Well, the next Act hasn't come into operation, so it has no legal effect. So this Act's the one that I have to look at. But everyone's telling me this Act doesn't apply to minerals, and I still can't find the answer, okay?
That is why we also went to the Constitutional Court for clarity, and they didn't pronounce it.
And they also didn't want to give it back. Well, if everyone's ducking the issue, maybe that's why we keep asking the question. So if the Constitutional Court also ducks, there's not much else we can do, eh? Sorry, go ahead. We'll find an answer to that.
With regard to the definition of listed activities, although the EIA process is the process to be used to inform a waste management license and an atmospheric emissions license, the licensing authorities in terms of the Waste Act and the Air Quality Act are not included in the definition of competent authority. The definition should be amended in line with the proposed amendments to Section 28 of NEMA to read, in respect of activities which require environmental authorization, means the organs of state charged with reviewing or deciding an application for environmental authorization. I seem to have gone ahead a slide there for that. The definition of listed activities reads, when used in Chapter 5, means an activity identified in terms of Section 24(2)(a) and D. Now, this definition excludes the other listing notices in terms of the Waste Act and the Air Quality Act. The definition should be amended to read, when used in Chapter 5, means an activity identified in terms of this Act or any of the specific Environmental Management Acts as an activity which requires environmental authorization. The proposed amended definition of the specific Environmental Management Act incorrectly refers to the Environmental Conservation Act. It should be Environment Conservation Act. A clause could also be inserted to highlight that other acts may also in the future be added to the list of acts which are regarded as CEMAs, just to clarify any confusion which is caused and why we've had to amend as we are now. In terms of Section 11, the question the department's asking essentially why a municipality is excluded in the preparation of an environmental implementation plan when they also exercise this function, which may affect the environment.
You're on good ground here. We also asked the question. Unfortunately, it looks like when this Act was drafted, none of those people are around anymore. They can't tell us why municipalities were excluded. And the further bigger problem that's now taking place, in some of the other clauses in the Act, they are including municipalities to have the powers. So you exclude them up front from the big picture, and now at the back you're giving them powers at the back, but you've got no mechanism to see what capacities they have, whether they've got plans, whether they haven't got plans. So it does seem it's one of the big political questions we flagged, is why are municipalities excluded from that whole infrastructure up front? I can imagine the question is going to come back and say, because they're not competent. But the problem is you cannot exclude municipalities who play an absolutely pivotal role. And if they don't have the capacity, well, we must try and create the capacity somehow. So from our point of view as a committee, it just seems that it was obviously deliberately excluded, but it does seem to create big problems. To create a proper environmental structure in government, if all your local governments are left out of their plans, they don't have to put plans forward. What they're doing about the environment, it just looks complete anomaly. So we you're on good ground at that point. We'll try and get an answer for it.
Thanks, Chair. Essentially, our proposal is that the municipality must prepare an environmental implementation plan within 1 year of this act and taking into effect, and at least every 5 years thereafter. This plan, of course, must be aligned with the provincial implementation plan. It's also not clear why strict adherence to an environmental outlook report being submitted within 4 years in terms of Section 16A3B is necessary in respect of municipalities when submission of a report is voluntary for the municipalities. In terms of Section 24(2)(A), this section permits the minister to prohibit or restrict the granting of an environmental authorization. If we go on to 24(2)(C), this provides that where the prohibition or restriction affects the exercise of a power that the MEC has in terms of this act, the prohibition or restriction contemplated in paragraph A may be published in a gazette after consulting the MEC affected by the prohibition or restriction notice. The minister is required to consult with the MEC in terms of section 24(2)(AE) and to publish in the gazette. Why then is the current proposed section 24(2)(C) necessary?
2A.
Essentially, there's a duplication. 24(2)(AE) requires for the consultation plus publishing in the gazette, and 24(2)(AC) also requires. There's also a concern of the use of the term may in the section, as well as concerns that the provisions may impede on the MEC's concurrent powers. Consider amending 2C(A), section 24(2)(AC) to read in consultation with rather than after consultation. Alternatively...
Sorry to interrupt you. I may be on the wrong page. I'm on page 5 of the bill, which is 2A. Which page are you... Because it looks like I'm reading the wrong clause.
So
two,
it's
length
24(2)(A).
24(2)(A) is clause 4 in the bill, is it? And then my 2A, small c, says the minister may by notice. Is it that clause you're talking about?
Yeah, it's on page 5.
Which one?
Yes,
C doesn't say anything about consulting, does it?
Yeah, it does. It's, if I just read it, it's where the prohibition or restriction affects the exercise of a power that the MEC has in terms of this act. The prohibition or restriction contemplated in paragraph A may be published in the Gazette after consultation with the MEC.
See, I must be blind. One of the department, come and show me which clauses.
It's clause 4, section 24(2)(A)(c). Yeah.
My small c is the minister may by notice. Just bring all the other MECs quickly. I really apologize for this, but I want to know what you're talking about. Mm. It's very unfair because I want to be listening to what you say. See, mine's different. Good gracious, we've got different bills. Can that be possible? Mine only goes up to D, theirs has got an E. B says looks like my bill doesn't have the C at all. It goes from the B and then it's got a C, but it's left out your C. Could you just quickly check which bill they've got so we can... That'll be very funny if we've got different bills.
Trying to do with 24 capital of 2 capital A is to strengthen the consulting requirements for the MEC. If I go on to 24 capital C, section 24 C deals with the procedure for identifying the competent authority. Section 24 C 2 provides that the minister must be identified as the competent authority in the circumstances which are listed in that section. Now, the proposed deletion of the exclusions which are provided for in that section, which essentially identify that the MEC will be the competent authority where those exclusions are applicable. The deletion of the exclusion has raised concerns about the very wide interpretation of will take place within an area protected by means of an international environmental instrument. Because the definition of international environmental instrument is widely defined as means any international agreement, declaration, resolution, convention, or protocol which relates to the management of the environment. It could, for instance, be argued that some of the things regulated in a biosphere reserve, which is proclaimed in terms of the UNESCO agreements, will now have to be decided by national environmental affairs. In addition to this, most of the Western Cape falls inside the Cape Floral Kingdom, which is a proclaimed World Heritage Site. Essentially, this could mean that a number of applications will now be referred to national departments, particularly with regards to the Western Cape. In addition to above, the phrase relates to the management of the environment itself could also be very widely interpreted, especially when read with the often general wording of a convention, the effect of which is that the minister could be responsible for granting environmental authorizations in respect of a large number of applications which were not intended to be dealt with at this level. We suggest that the implications for this removal be considered. The insertion of the proposed provision that will empower the minister to take a decision away from the MEC if the MEC missed time frames has also raised concerns about unnecessary impeding on provinces' concurrent powers. We also have concerns with regards to the practicalities of this situation, especially because most of these decisions are delegated by the MEC to the department as the first decision maker. Any appeal would then go to the MEC, the current procedure. Now, in those situations, it's unclear how this procedure would work given the proposed amendments. Our possible solutions to this is that nothing stops the MEC and the Minister from reaching an agreement in terms of 24 capital C subsection 3 that the Minister may deal with or take over an application and finalize it if a province is actually battling to finalize an application. An alternative to the proposed amendment is that the minister should request reasons for the delay from the MEC, and upon request reasons for the delay from the MEC, the request to the MEC would then be made on request by the applicant.
To build in a few hoops before you just take over the power.
Essentially, yes.
Because it may be, the power is not left to an applicant. So it's not a political issue, because the applicant may be anyone. So the applicant can ask for the time frame that hasn't been met. But the problem is to not create hoops they have to jump through first. For example, as you suggest, create a procedure whereby if the applicant does ask the minister, the minister must then first do this and this and this before we look at that. Over and above, of course, I do take those constitutional issues seriously. I think the way the clause is worded now, if it's not brought in under a clause in the Constitution linked to it, for example, 125 or 100, it's not linked to it. Just standing on its own, I think, is going to pick up constitutional problems. So I think that those points you're making is good. And maybe you practical, so you practically can see what is possible. So if you have further suggestions for us, what kind of buffers do we create before a minister takes it over? So if we get that far, of course, I'm assuming we get that far in terms of the constitutionality. But if we do that, what do we build in? So for example, as you said, the minister asked, can I please have your reasons why you're failing to do this, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe we can look at directives. Most times we use directives where the minister can then direct, but please do this by these dates. All those kind of examples that you can think of practically that may be as buffers before we get to a taking over of a power. And then, as I say, if we get that far, that in any case will have to be linked to some clause in the Constitution. It can't just stand on its own like this. It will be unconstitutional, I think. Okay?
Essentially what we're worried about there is the possible abuse by developers and applicants of such a provision, and trying to almost cater for creating delays, which would then almost guarantee that applications do immediately go up to national.
That should be another reason. I mean, there shouldn't be a referral higher up if the delay is the applicant. I mean, there you should just exclude such a thing until the applicant has complied with what you need.
Mm.
So there seems to be a lot of buffers one can build in if we get that far. Okay?
The other issue would be that there wouldn't be an appeal to any decision then, which, if it had to be referred up to the national minister potentially, where the normal procedure would allow anyone aggrieved by the decision to appeal to the MEC.
It's very clear that if we go this route, if the committee politically decides to go this route, there's going to have to be a lot of work done with this clause. It can't stand like this.
The waste management listed activities were expressly included in the previous draft, we've noted. This would have meant that there would no longer be the need to rely on the legal interpretation of Section 5 of the Waste Act, read with the definition of environmental authorization and equating the definition of a waste management activity in the Waste Act with the definition of a listed activity in NEMA in order for the section to apply. The issue is essentially that the minister published a list of waste management activities under Section 19(1) of the Waste Act, and while Section 24(2A) allows the minister to identify activities which may not commence without environmental authorization, the activities provided for in the Waste Act were not listed or specified in terms of Section 24(2A) or B. The new draft has left Section 24(F) unamended. Thus, the uncertainty will remain as to whether Section 24F applies to the Waste Act and the Air Quality Act. It's also noted in this regard that the amendments which specifically included the Waste Act in the previous draft have now been left in the amended proposal to Section 24G while they've been removed from Section 24F. What we consider proposing for Section 24F, capital F1, is as follows. That notwithstanding any other act, no person may commence with an activity listed or specified in terms of Section 24 2A or B, which includes an activity listed or specified in terms of a specific Environmental Management Act, unless the competent authority has granted an environmental authorization for the activity. It's also not clear why the wording or the Minister of Minerals or Energy, as the case may be, is required in this section when the section itself specifically refers to the competent authority. And if you have regard to the competent authority, it does link it back to the Minister of Minerals and Energy where it's relevant.
Do you think that's a duplication?
In terms of Section 24F2E, it must be determined whether a Section 31L compliance notice can be issued for non-compliance with a normal standard for non-listed activities. This will have implications for whether or not there are any administrative enforcement mechanisms available to enforce compliance with regards to your norms and standards, and particularly for your non-listed activities. The current proposed wording for Section 24G and Section 24.10A would not permit someone who has commenced with an activity in contravention with the norm or standard developed for non-listed activities to apply for rectification. Section 24F1A relates to the commencement with a listed or specified activity without environmental authorization, and Section 24F1B deals with a listed activity which does not require environmental authorization when done in terms of an applicable norm or standard. Now, the proposed amendments to Section 24.10A, read with the proposed 24F2F, mean that it would be an offence for someone to commence with a norm or standard developed for non-listed activities, but Section 24G doesn't permit them to apply for rectification. In my comments that we submitted, I've proposed wording to amend that section. The proposed insertion of Section 24G1B that is submitted is not needed if the above-mentioned amendments to Section 24F1, those are on page 7 of 14 of my comments, are made so as to include similar activities listed or specified in terms of a specific Environmental Management Act. We've also noted that the Air Quality Act was not similarly included in both the previous and current drafts. Now, this will prevent someone who has committed an offence in terms of the Air Quality Act from applying for Section 24G rectification. It's unclear whether or not a policy decision has been made to permit Section 24G applications to be granted by the relevant authorities, which in most of these cases for the Air Quality Act will be the relevant municipality. A further proposal we're suggesting is that you consider including the words "or continued" after commencement in Section 24G1A. This would allow for a subsequent owner of a property in respect of which a listed activity was previously commenced with and themselves have continued with the listed activity without environmental authorization to apply for 24G. The issue there is essentially that the subsequent owner themselves haven't commenced with the listed activity and therefore are unable to lawfulize what has been done by the previous owner. And going on to Section 24G1. On application by a person who has commenced or continued with a listed or specified activity without an environmental authorization in contravention of Section 24F1, the Minister of Minerals and Resources or the MEC concerned, as in the case of A and B, may direct the applicant to. That's the proposed wording for Section 24G. Also removing the Section 24G1 B that was proposed to be included in these amendments. I put on to Section 24G4, Subsection 4. There is no definition of an emergency response situation. Now, this will make it extremely difficult for your enforcement officials, as they will have to refute claims from members of the public claiming that they have commenced with a listed activity in order to protect human life or the environment. Now, having regard to the above, it's foreseeable that this provision will be manipulated by transgressors in order to avoid having to pay an administrative fine. What we're proposing is that the wording be amended so that Section 24G, the administrative fine will not be payable when someone is directed to undertake a listed activity in terms of Section 30 of the National Environmental Management Act. This will ensure that members of the public contact the relevant authority in order to ascertain whether they regard the situation to be an emergency, in terms of which a directive can be issued which would direct certain activities to occur without environmental authorization. Now, this procedure would also ensure that only those activities that are required to be undertaken to address the emergency situation are undertaken and not a whole development. Essentially, the proposed wording that
I can see this can become a nightmare. I mean, this department will be the first one to come and ask, please remove this clause. Because, I mean, you're going to try and you're going to create emergencies, you're going to do whatever you can to avoid the fines. Because this is a defense we've created. Instead of leaving it to the administrative process, and in the administrative process, if someone comes and shows you there is an emergency, or even to say you can come and show in the process of the administrative fine to come and show if there was a, then we will not deal with, as you're saying, with it, rather than giving it as an absolute defense. It just seems to me make much more sense. This could become a big problem otherwise.
Essentially, the proposed wording that we're submitting is that subsection 2A, or subsection 24G4, read, subsection 2A is not applicable to a person contemplated in section 1A who has commenced with a listed or specified activity when directed to do so in terms of Section 30. We could possibly include the subsection there, subsection 6. We've got similar wording which I'll go on later in terms of Section 28, also in Section 30, and also the criminal offences created by those. The proposed amended Section 24G4 states that administrative fine is excluded if a person has commenced with a listed or specified activity in an emergency response situation in order to protect human life or the environment. I've just gone through my comments on that. Now, it should be considered whether a similar exclusion for criminal liability should be included in Section 28A. When a directive is issued in terms of Section 28 or Section 30. There is an interpretation that permits a directive issued in terms of Section 28 and or Section 30 with the necessary amendments to the comments I'm about to make to direct someone who has caused or may cause significant pollution or degradation of the environment and wants to responsibly proceed to take those measures without having to obtain environmental authorization if those measures will trigger a listed activity. Now, in such situations, only those measures which are required to remedy the ongoing significant pollution or degradation will be permitted without obtaining prior environmental authorization. The remainder of the steps to be taken in terms of the directive, i.e. your non-urgent steps, should then follow either a normal Section 24G application route or a 24 route or a 24G application route, depending on the circumstances. The issue then arises as to whether the person directed to undertake such measures will be committing an offence in terms of Section 24F1, which is the commencement of illicit activity without environmental authorization, in addition to potentially contravening the proposed Section 28A1, which is the breach of the duty of care. Now, this matter is further complicated in that if the person does not comply with the directive, they will be committing an offence in terms of the proposed 28A, subsection 2, which is the failure to comply with a 28 directive. In other words, it should be possible to direct someone to commence with a listed activity in terms of section 28 and or a section 30 directive without the person being criminally liable. Such a person should still be liable for an offence in terms of section 28A for negligence, if that's applicable. So essentially, you can't create your own emergency situation, which would then get you out of being criminally liable. But if the department directs you to undertake certain activities in order to either combat significant environmental degradation which is occurring, or in the terms of an emergency situation, a directive could be issued which could force someone to undertake a listed activity without the authorization.
Relate directly back to your proposals on the emergency. So in other words, one doesn't create a nebulous emergency, you create a permission granted from the competent authority, and because of that, that cannot be then criminalized.
Yeah, I've taken care to link all of these, the relevant provisions and my proposals to each other. I mean, it is quite a complicated sort of procedure you'd have to follow to have regard to all of the amendments, but if you take them all into account, they do all follow.
What you can do with that kind of proposal where people ask for permission, is you then in the regulations provide a procedure. You know, it could be a specific form you fill in, and then which the department then has to process quickly. If there's an emergency pending, then you create in regulations the whole procedure as a speeded up procedure which the department will then decide on within day or whatever.
Yeah, so your Section 30 directives are usually issued on extremely short time periods. So there are procedures within most of the departments, as far as I understand it, to deal with those and to get those issued quite quickly. The next one, given the proposed amendments to Section 24G, which enables someone to apply once they've commenced with a listed activity and not upon committing an offence, in terms of Section 24F2A, a decision will have to be made whether the legislation should allow the person to apply for 24G, apply in terms of 24G, which is as amended by this bill, in respect of those activities they will be directed to undertake. Alternatively, whether an exclusion should be made from paying the Section 24G2A administrative fine in respect of those activities they were directed to undertake.
In practice, can you give us an example of such an emergency?
My next slide is, cater to a bit of that. The current wording of Section 30, we're of the opinion, is problematic because it is interpreted by some to mean that Section 30 cannot be used to address floods or any other natural disaster. Now, this is a major concern for many municipalities and other authorities. To answer your question, some other examples would be a chemical spill from an oil tanker or those sort of incidents.
Floods, natural disasters.
When we have the floods and get washed away.
Bridges.
And you need that 5 cubic meters. Move 5 cubic meters or so. Yeah. And then you're contravening the listed activity because you've got to move that. Mm. And it's in the water course.
Mm. Essentially, Chair, what we stating here is that there's different interpretations of what is an incident. As far as I understand it, National does not regard your flood to be an emergent incident which Section 30 can be used, while the Western Cape does regard it to be an emergency instance in terms of Section 30 directive can be issued. What we're proposing here is to consider amending the definition of incident to be similar to that as used in the Disaster Management Act. Now we propose some amended wording, which are in my comments, just to adapt the definition as used in the Disaster Management Act so that it can be used in this section. We'd also, Chair, ask that you consider amending Section 31B, which deals with the responsible person, by inserting an additional subsection which reads as subsection 6, subsection IV, sorry, that any other person directed in terms of subsection 6 to urgently take steps to address the incident. Now, this is simply to allow that even the landowner or the person in control of the land, so that they can be directed in terms of Section 30 to take emergency steps. If you read the wording of Section 31B, it's very prescriptive in terms of who can be issued with a directive, and essentially we're proposing that that wording be widened so as to allow for the owner of land in terms of along the banks of a river for him to be directed to undertake certain emergency steps to prevent erosion or similar things happening. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I can't pretend to understand all this because obviously one has to understand the legislation well to understand all the proposals, but it does seem to me there's a lot of stuff there that's worth looking at. I particularly like the issues around the emergency to deal with that differently. I think that it's going to be necessary for us to look at that, but of course the department still have a chance to comment on that. Questions, comments? It's all of it's sort of quite a technical nature, except around the alleged unconstitutional clause that, of course, the department is worried about some politics there, which clearly we should take into consideration. Can I suggest that when you process these amendments, this is a government department, so there's no reason why you can't pick up the phone and talk and make sure we fully understand what it is that at a practical level the provinces are, or at least this province is having. So please, let's make sure we process all these amendments and suggestions in a way that is in a cooperative government. Okay. Let me just make sure I understand all this. Seeing as there are no questions.
Chair, if I may, the comments that we've submitted, I have tried to include the relevant sections of the legislation, as well as highlight how we would propose the amendments to be made. I know these are quite technical amendments, so I have tried to go into a bit of detail and do it step by step in a lot of these.
Oh yeah, this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you got this one? Yeah. Lovely. All right. Can I thank you. As I said, please get a copy of the certified just to check. And if you have any more comments to make, you're free to make them to us, even on things that we may raise with you. We may not have another public hearing, but I circulate it to the members if you make more comments. So if you want to make anything more, or you know, once you've looked at the certified copy, there may be things that you would want to look at differently, then please feel free to do so. Okay?
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much to all three of you. Much appreciated for your time and effort. Now, that's the last of the public hearings. I think that we've received a few submissions, but I think most of the submissions were of a good quality, if not all. So I really think it was was good, and some of them are raising quite big issues. Now, the way I want the department to process this, of course, is to take each section, whether we made suggestions or whether the submission from the submissions they were made, under each section, if there was a suggestion made to amend something, whether we said we like it or don't like it, doesn't matter. You put it in there under each section. So when we process it, we'll process by sections.
Okay.
Secondly, Ms. Dawood, this document you did, the one with all the legislation that you've color-coded, quickly explain to us what procedure you followed, because I see there's some red, there's some yellow, there's some blue, and I can't fully explain it to myself, so maybe you must just explain what you've done so when people read it, they can understand.
Okay, when I received an electronic copy of the pieces of legislation from the department, the yellow is the amendments to NEMA 1998. So the yellow is the 2009 amendments.
Which have not been put into operation?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, that helps.
And
okay.
Then the red is the ones that are affected with NEMLA.
The red.
Red and blue.
The red. And then the blue? The blue is usually scheduled this section, this. Is that just because it's numerical? Or shouldn't we worry too much about the blue? See, it's usually numerical. Chapter 5, section 46, section. So it's the red really we must look at. The red is the proposed amendments now in this bill. And the yellow is what was previously amended but not put into operation. Okay. So the red and yellow. The yellow is just worth looking at because there are amendments but they've just not been put into operation. Okay, now that's clever. So that helps us. Alright, so there's a whole lot of things that I want you to do. Now the next meeting will be next week. 5 September, but I'm unfortunately going to have to ask you to be here in the morning, although you're not necessarily. What we've done, I'm going to go through the program now with the committee. We've asked the Department of Water to come the previous day to come and tell us about the National Water Resource Strategy, and I've also provisionally put aside the morning of the 5th if we spill over. Now, if we don't spill over, we need to continue. Okay. So, just take it that the next time you'll have to be as the 5th for the day, and then in the morning of the 6th. And, yeah, basically the 6th as well, because if we don't do something of those, we'll have to ask you to jump in. Okay. So the 5th and the 6th, we'll start processing all those things, not only the proposed amendments, but all the other things we ask you. Like this whole issue of mineral affairs, which I'm just too dumb to understand. I need to understand that. There's the memo on this, other processes of yours. There's other memos I asked. There's the one on the traditional leaders, which I've received today in opinion. I think you probably need to look at the legalities of this section, which they're saying is unconstitutional. An opinion. Well, you better give me that opinion, let me look at it, because I think what people are raising is right. There's a problem. Make both available, because it seems to me the only time you can take over powers is we've provided for it in the Constitution. So if you don't link your clause to section 100 or to 125, that means that you are directly in legislation intervening in provincial powers. Now, I don't see how we're going to do that constitutionally. In any case, I think some thought must be given about the staggering process. Not that if an applicant's unhappy, then they ask. that there must be some other thing that first gets done. Directives, reasons for why it's not being, whatever it is, before we get to taking over the power, which is quite drastic and create it under. And then, of course, if we do create such a process, you must give some thought to what we're going to set out in the legislation, because clearly it's not enough yet. We have to set out the processes. The issue the gentleman raises about how will you do it with documentation and so on. Now, I think he overstated the claim, but that doesn't matter. The point is there has to be a process how you will make sure that those things can take place. Okay. So there's a whole lot of stuff that needs to be done before next week, so get it all done. Wasn't there an input we asked on something? Was there an input which wasn't given that we asked you must prepare for?
Chair, we've got a list of 11 inputs that you asked for.
Oh.
The one was the use of the state and organs of state in the act.
Oh, yes, that's the one. Yes, good.
Then the issue around the human health, section 24 and 28 case studies, environmental management plans and implementation plans, the issue of the municipalities, then the strengthening of penalties under the NEMBA, the reason behind imposing national requirements when there's existing provincial provisions, and then you also wanted the minister's speech for Komakas around those.
I think I was given it today.
Yeah.
Or not, I printed it today. Is this the prospecting one?
Yes, the bioprospecting.
Did you give me that? Oh, why did I didn't that? You don't ever give me copies. No, but you leave me out of the loop. I mean, I don't get anything. I got to go and print this on my own computer. I look at it, I find it there, I print it. So I bring it here because you haven't given it to me. Only other members get it. For some reason, the chair gets left out of the loop.
I've got your list.
You've got those things. Okay. Now, well, that's good. Could you give that to, at the end of today, after we've done that, can you give to Leka so we can just check it and so on and just make sure there aren't more stuff, okay? Anything else we should ask before they come? And I think we've asked everything. If they follow up, we're not going to finish in one day. It's not going to be done in one day, so it's okay. All right. Now, can we quickly go to the program? You were sent a program which I've since then changed because a whole lot of things came up, not least of all, of course, the processing of this bill. There was no space for the processing of the bill. So what I've gotten,
did you give them the new copy?
Oh, you gave them the new copy. I start on page 9. So next week is a committee week. Is it? No, this week. This week we won't sit tomorrow. Because we'll give them, we were going to sit with NEMLA if there were further public hearings. So we'll give them tomorrow so they can now go and do all the work they have to do. Okay? So we won't sit tomorrow. And of course we won't sit on Friday, Charlie. No sitting on Friday. I can see you're very happy, Charlie. So the week after is a committee week. So we'll be on the whole week for committees without plenary. Now, what I've set down is on the 4th of September, the whole day, we'll be taking a briefing on the DWRS, which you should have a copy of. Have you given them a copy? Okay. You've given them a copy of this copy? It's the new National Water Resource Strategy. Probably one of the most vital documents in water, so we're going to have to look at this thing properly. So we set down the whole day, and then the next morning, I've also set that morning down provisionally if it runs over. It shouldn't, but just in case it does. Then the fifth, four international agreements were referred to us for processing in the ATC of the 23rd and the 27th, I think. The one is the Lesotho Highland Phase 2. The second one is Annex B of the Kyoto Protocol. The next one is the Nagoya Protocol, and the fourth one is the African Convention on Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources. So those four documents. So on the 6th, on the 5th, either the morning or, okay, we won't expect them to be in the morning, so they can be in the afternoon that they're going to brief us on those agreements, okay? So if we start with the legislation, we'll start in the morning and we can then have those briefings and continue with legislation. So they don't have to also come early. So those four agreements, the briefing we'll receive on the 5th. And then we'll also process the bill on the 5th. And if the NWRS runs over whatever time is needed, we'll do that. But you guys will be in the morning, so if we have to start, we'll call you to come over. Okay? So that's the 5th. The 6th in the morning, we continue with the processing of NEMLA to give us enough time to go at least go through all of it and try and give instructions. And then in the afternoon, we'll do two things. Firstly, we'll get that briefing on these processes with mineral resources. That's the briefing we received a few months, weeks ago, but they told us it will be finished in August, so we need now a briefing to see how finished that process is. You can smile, I can see, Cornelia. Of course, here you must go and invite the Portfolio Committee of Mineral Resources. Go to the committee clerk and tell them that they're more than welcome to attend that if they want to. It's a briefing we're going to receive, okay? Then there's something been in the news which we haven't ever dealt with, is RDISA, the tires. Now, I read somewhere, Shireen, you sent it to me, that that plan has been again reactivated. So it's our new plan and so on. So I think it's time we receive just a short briefing on it. So I've said about some time there, at least we're going to get a bite of it, and if it's needed to do more, then we can follow up. So RDISA also on the 6th.
Can I just suggest an alternative wording and possible brief?
Hmm.
I mean, you'll know from the media that there are contested plans. Yes, we must have a briefing on the RDISA plan, but we should rather say briefing on waste tire management plan. Because I don't know if the committee should appear to be showing any favoritism over plans. The other plan has been considered still, and it's in the mix.
Oh, I thought it was agreed to. That's the message I got.
It's not at the exclusion of any other plan.
Oh.
I'm correct. So I think we should have a briefing on the waste tire plan.
So what is the idea? They've approved one plan and they're looking at the other plan. Maybe we're premature in looking at it.
Possibly, but I'm saying you can't have one.
You tell us, Ms. Mashi, could you find out whether we're just a bit premature with this, or will it be possible for you to brief us on all the plans? But at least we've got an idea of it without expressing views on it at the moment. But at least because I haven't got a clue what's going on. I mean, there was a court case and there was a drawn, and then, so I really don't know what's going on. And I mean, I got people asking the Minister of Science and Technology, some people in the audience the other day asked her about this tire thing, and I just ducked. Because I knew she shouldn't be asked. It's probably someone like us, and I haven't got a clue what's going on. So this is why I can't remember this. So could you come back to us? Look, the idea is not to try and for us here to decide which is a good or a bad plan. For us is to get the information. So I need the information at this stage, okay? I wasn't even aware there's some other plans that are still being considered, for example. I just knew that the one, Shireen let me know, the one was approved or something. So that briefing, it would be good if we can have it then, even if it's just to tell us what is going on without us going into much detail. But let me know about that, okay? And then if it's so, then of course we can reword it and look at all the plans. So that's on the 6th. The 7th is the Friday. So for Dr. Huang, I've kept that open at this stage. We may very well sit on that Friday because we've got so much work. But it's still left open at this stage, Dr. Huang. Dr. Huang and other members. Sorry, let me just say and other members. For the Friday. Then the week after, starting on the 11th and the 12th, the 11th, we'll also continue with, so we'll try and take a day until we've processed NEMLA. So on the 11th, we'll also do NEMLA. Whatever has happened the previous week, we've given instructions on, we'll continue with that. On the Tuesday morning, And on the Tuesday, on the Wednesday morning, we want further briefings from both Departments of Water and Environment on the MDGs. How are we doing with the MDGs? That's a follow-up input from what we received previously, okay? On the 12th. And then on the 18th and 19th, I think it is, or 17th and 18th, the Wednesday and the Tuesday, we've also set down NEMLA. So to really try and process it this term as far as we can, okay? So NEMLA, and then there's these other inputs, the NWC, this waste thing, tires, and the mining thing, and the MDGs. Those are all this term, okay? And try to spend. Then next term, we have to start with those stupid BRRs. I say that advisedly, stupid BRRs, because it's any case. But before we do that, we're going to a Goro. The waste management office is Goro in East London. For 2 days, on Monday the 8th and Tuesday the 9th. It's actually interesting. It's where they call all these municipalities together. The minister, the deputy minister calls them together, and then they discuss all these waste and sanitation problems they have, and they have... We went up to that one in Limpopo this year, remember? So I've asked for all the members to go to this, because I think waste is one of the problems where if we don't give direction, no one's going to give direction. It was clear from the inputs we had last time at the climate change that those departments dealing with waste clearly do not have a clue what's going on. So this is a good for us to go and have a look at that. And then on the Wednesday and the Thursday, and provisionally on the Friday, we're keeping open for Department of Water to come and do whatever they must come and brief us on BRRR. There is a document now that Chileka can circulate to you. We had a meeting as chairpersons the other day, and they gave us a guideline of what must be done in these BRRs. It's actually just basically everything that's ever happened must be done. Now, I've decided to do everything that has to be happened in 2 days. I'm not going to waste more time than that. But she'll send you the guide so you can see what kind of things they're saying. I raised with the chairperson's committee again to say, but the problem is you've got the whole process wrong. If you don't realign the process with the executive process, then it's no use. Because by the time we look at this stuff, they tell us, look at all the things we looked at in the beginning of the year. The strategic panel. But we've looked at it and we've approved it already. It's approved. We've approved it. Now we now have to re-look at it again, and all we add is an annual plan or something else. In any case, look at that guide, and we're then going to, Chileka's busy drafting a letter to both the minister for both departments, just to say, this is what you need to give us an input on, you know, and list it, and then hopefully we can do something in that. So the first 2 days, and then the Friday provisionally we keep for water, and the next Tuesday and Wednesday we keep for environment, and then we must adopt the report on the 18th. The deadline for adoption is the 18th, so the next day. So Cherie, Ms. Dawood, you can start drafting the report, taking the last 2 years' report, and then when you get to the two departments' report, just change the years and the thing, and we'll just adopt a similar report. You can start drafting so we're ready on the 18th, okay? Thank you. That's how seriously we take this. So those 2 weeks are committee weeks, and we'll spend it then on this BRR, okay? And the Goro. The Goro. Goro sounds like it is. Then for 2 weeks after that, I've set aside in October 2 weeks for public hearings around the National Water Resource Strategy. So the briefings we're going to get next week, we're then going to, in a month's time, ask for public hearings. For 2 weeks, I've set aside all 4 of those days, including the Fridays, for 2 weeks, and depending on how many... Now, the press statement Ms. Dawood has drafted for me today, I'll have a look at it, hopefully we'll send it out for comments from the public for those 2 weeks in end of October, okay? So those are 2 weeks of public hearings on the National Water Resource Strategy. Then the week after that, we want the progress report from our Rhino workshop. That's the week of 6 November. And 7 November, we want the Waste Management Strategy Progress Report. The waste management meeting we had in Good Hope, they must then remember we asked them to do a whole lot of stuff and redraft. They must come and then report back to us. So that week we get progress reports on rhinos and waste management, okay? Then the week after, it's a briefing on acid mine drainage, including the long-term solutions. So that trip we went on recently. And then I've set aside a day on Wednesday the 14th, a joint meeting with other committees. Chileka, we instruct you now to go and talk to the secretaries of all those committees. It's water, it's human settlements, it's us, it's finance, it's appropriations, SCOPA, around this whole sanitation policy thing. So hopefully that's given people some time to look at the sanitation policy. We would have already received our report back from our workshop that we had, or our briefing we had. We will receive the progress report when we have this meeting. So we see if we can't pull some things together. I have briefly discussed this with Ms. Dambuza, the Chair of Human Settlements, and she also clearly thinks that there are problems and so on. So I want us to see if we can't sit down. And of course, Treasury, Mr. Machi, and them are very worried about this. They already have a lot of other plans in Treasury. So try and pull everyone together so we can hear what's going on. And then in the last week, you'll see that's starting 20 November. You'll see they've given us a committee week on the 27th of November. That's after we've adjourned. There's two committee weeks. Now that's Parliament just trying to cover it back to say, well, we gave committee a lot of 2 weeks' work. Of course, the problem is that's when everyone's adjourned. Now I have set down that week of the 27th for us to look at the implementation of the white paper. I've set it down there provisionally. But my feeling is, and the committee must comment on this, my feeling is it's going to be a waste of time. They're clearly not ready for it. So what I've asked as an alternative on the 20th for Ms. Beaumont to come and brief us on how far she's got. That's now the unit of DEA dealing with climate change. Just for her to come down and come and brief us on the 20th to say how far she's got. So we can then see if we can plan something for January or February to have a week where we look again at climate change, okay, as we promised February. So that's the proposal there, and we'll leave in this public hearings for a week, but I don't think it'll work. And then the last one is on the 21st, that briefing we wanted on the environmental impact assessment regime. Some of it now part of this stuff here, but it's the practical things we wanted them to come and brief us on. So I've tried all the outstanding issues and issues we've been briefed on. We need reports and the work that we're processing. I've tried to all put it in this program. It fits in like it is now. Of course, if something major happens, we'll have a problem, but that's as it is. Any comments? Any, Mr. Morgan?
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the work you put into it. It's very comprehensive, and indeed pretty much covers, I think, everything we've ever mentioned. I don't think it's a good idea to even provisionally schedule the climate change stuff. The week it exactly overlaps with the first week of COP18. So, in fact, any relevant official from any department is going to be in Qatar. But I like the idea of the 20th of November.
Will she still be here?
I don't know.
So Will you just check with Ms. Beaumont? We may have to make her shift it maybe with acid mine drainage or something.
That might be a good idea, Chair.
Yeah.
Just some other...
But let's leave it there, just so that the people that draft programs in Parliament think we've got a program.
It might get them to do some work in the department, knowing that they have to come to us. Two other issues of which I think one is more important, which I'd like you to consider, Chair. One is a briefing on the water tribunal. I don't know enough about it, but I'm concerned that this tribunal isn't meeting. They haven't had a chairperson since December last year, and they are now using mediation and roundtable talks to try and get people to work out water disputes.
Can I suggest that on the when they come next week, giving the NWRS, that you raise whatever you want to there, and we then decide what we want to do first.
Okay. That is the one that I just got. So I think I'll raise it happily, but they may need to give us a substantial report. So I'd appreciate your support then on that. And the other thing is, similarly, and it can be raised next week as well, because we haven't had it for, I don't think we've had this briefing since early last year. Just the update on how the Department of Water is doing on the granting of water use licenses, their time frames, backlogs, and in all the various sectors. I think it's an important briefing to have, just to get a determination of whether, in fact, they're getting better or worse.
I think what you must do is raise that next week, and then we'll decide whether how we take it forward, whether we need a further briefing.
I have to
do that. Lovely. I think those are important. Yes, Mr. Scusano.
Chairperson, I just want to ask in relation to issues of climate change. Last year we saw active meetings after meetings dealing with COP17 running up and down. But this year, is there any progress in relation to that? Because last week I received a phone call that asked me whether I'm coming to the meeting or not here in Parliament while I was at home. The steering committee, but no program, no invitation. I said, no, I'm not coming. I don't know.
Really, I also didn't go. Look, I think it still exists, and they were trying to move and give tasks. Like, for example, we proposed that the issues around the white paper should be looked by us as a committee, and they've agreed to that. So these week-long things we invite people to come and report, that's with their blessing. But the committee as such still exists. I mean, I was called in last week into a meeting on the greening of Parliament. So we've now starting to green Parliament. But I think that is a redundant process. You see, the problem is, of course, the point you're raising is a very valid one, because Qatar is taking place. So what is Parliament's preparation for Qatar? And I wonder how we deal with this. Obviously, the department, you people are probably processing all that stuff already, eh? You're dealing with the climate change of going to COP18. Manila, could you check with us, Ms. Mashi? I struggle with this, Ms. Mashi. Could you check for us whether, with the DG, whether it's worthwhile the department briefing us on the preparations for COP18? Maybe we can then invite others come to our meeting, and maybe they can hear some things and galvanize. Ms. Hussan, is that all right? We do it like that. We'll check if the DG and them are available to come and brief us on COP18, what's happening, where it's going, what are the issues and so on. Then we try and invite the others to come as well. So we'll make space in wherever in our program to have an input like that. Okay? So that's a good point to make. Okay? Any others? So we're happy with a program like this. Of course, it's always subject to change, but all right, at least it gives me something to work with. If you can give it to make sure that we have sent it to the minister and the DGs, but make sure that Babalwa, is her name Babalwa? The little one in water and Kwanele, please let them know that they can make sure all these things get done. Some of these are short notice, like the waste strategies and stuff, so if work needs to be done, it needs to be done in time. All right, I think that's it, so we'll see you guys next week, Wednesday morning. We'll get the briefing on the agreements Wednesday afternoon, and depending if we see you in the afternoon or the morning, okay? Anything else from the committee? Look, the other thing about the Chinese thing, you know, we've run out of time, but we received a nasty letter from Durko, I regard it as nasty. It's one of those letters from some official in Durko field that they can write to us and say quite ugly things, actually. Something similar like, can we really ask them to entertain such stupid programs? You know, something almost as stupid as that. So I decided, and I know I'm going to get into trouble for it, but I don't care anymore. I'm here for too long to worry about it. So we've gone straight to the Chinese. Straight. Charlie, as interpreter, talking for us. And so we're now talking directly to the ambassador and not... I think, whatever we do, I suppose September is going to be too soon. So we'll have to try and see how we can cut our cloth somewhere else and maybe ask them how it's going to be possible somewhere else. But just to say that that's what we've done now. We've left Durko and we've gone straight to the Chinese. Mr. Morgan.
Chairperson, thanks. I suspect it's probably too late as well. But, I mean, one of the things you may just want to consider as well is perhaps we can do that 2-3 day trip to the Lesotho Highlands at that time. It's somewhat international, and I'm sure it would be of fairly negligible cost as far as trips go. And the reason, bearing in mind the reason we didn't do it was because of the weather, and no doubt the weather will be much better.
We can definitely do that. You know that letter they sent us? Lady, speak to that lady and see, say, if we do want to come somewhere in September, October, will there be any problems? So then we can look at which dates preferable. But we'll still look at the Chinese thing. We're interacting. They've drafted a letter now. Look at it today and see how we take it forward. I think that's it. That's everything. Okay. Let's adjourn the meeting. We'll see each other next Tuesday. We'll have the briefings on the national, which I'm looking forward to, the National Water Resource Strategy. That's a major policy document for this government. And we'll say whatever time. I'll also get the press statement out today. Okay. Meeting adjourned. Thank you for the debate. And look, I'll